Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Early Work, the show in which I force writers and performers to come and read the creative writing of their youth. This week's guest is Ivo Graham. He is one of my favourite comedians. His last show was easily one of the best stand-up shows that I saw last year, or any year. And he also happens to be exceptional company. He's a genuine friend of mine. Guests on this show have all been lovely, of course. Some people I've met a handful of times. Mostly people, though, on this show are people I've known for years. But probably, if I'm honest, looking back, I only consider six of them to be actual friends of mine. Feel free to try and work out which ones, and feel free to tweet the ones you think that I don't count as friends. Let's start some beef. That's what we need in lockdown, isn't it? A good bit of online beef. But don't tweet Ivo, because he is number seven in the list of friends. As you'll hear, he was an uncreative child at Eton, but would occasionally reach for moments to put himself out there. And obviously, just as his brand ensures, they all end in humiliation. His work was some hilariously tangential and childishly dark stories about drink driving, storms, monsters, and frankly, Gary Neville. Also, as a child, he had maybe the most innocent and misguided view of what happens in pubs I've ever heard. This one is a big belter. Here is the early work of Ivo Graham. Joining me this week on Early Work is the one and only Ivo Graham. Hello, Ivo.
Hello, Reese. How are you doing?
Now, for listeners, I'm not too bad, thank you. I'm just going to introduce you to the listeners if they don't know. Ivo is best known, probably, for the various gambling addictions I've attempted to give him from meeting after gigs in various Leicester Square nightclubs for an Ocean's 13 roulette system or the lockdown poker empire I have encouraged Ivo to serve.
Wow. So I was stealing myself for a humiliating panel show appearance, of which there are so many to choose from, but you've actually gone into my even more shameful real-life experiences. and why not? Important to say early doors.
I have, to be fair, blamed myself for them. I mean, I'm not putting this directly on you.
Oh, very much so. And specifically with our joint efforts in Empire Casinos, Leicester Square, I think you started something and then walked away through a mixture of intelligence, restraint, and not doing quite as many gigs at the 99 Club, which will very generously sometimes book you, particularly on a Friday and Saturday, for two or even three quite close to each other, but with these slightly agonizing half-hour gaps in between. Obviously, in the grander scheme of things, you're still, you know, it's a very short working day. But nonetheless, what do? You can go to M&M World, you can go to Wasabi Sushi and Bento, or you'll do what I started to do with increasing regularity in the summer of 2018, which is go and attempt to master the martingale method of doubling down at the roulette table at Empire Casinos, which obviously you can't master. You can just grow more and more deluded and risky in. And I told my brother about this quite recently. And we were playing cards with my brother and his girlfriend after a few drinks during lockdown. And his girlfriend said, like, really whimsically, like, have you ever actually been to a casino? And I was like, have I been to a casino? Let me tell you. And
so, and I, casino? I haven't heard that name for 20 years.
the enthusiasm, which I was like, because I was just sort of thinking, she's cast her line out for an anecdote, not even expecting anything. And she's inadvertently walked into the hornet's nest of... sort of slightly shameful.
A haunted cool. expression on your face as you crack your knuckles to tell this story.
And I was like, so yeah, this is method where basically you, even if you don't win at first, you win second or third or fourth. But the point is you win eventually. And it's just basic maths. And I started doing it with some friends while I was gigging. And then actually I got so into it that sometimes I would go even without my friends. And I just watched their faces go, oh, right.
Oh, no.
Is that all right? I said, no. Obviously, I did stop quite soon, which I did. But, I kept an iPhone note of my ups and my downs, just financially rather than emotionally, although obviously sure. they're entirely proportional to one another. And and I walked away from the great Martingale experiment of 2018.
Well, we moved on from Martingale, especially as we went into lockdown. We'd moved on long before that, but then we went into lockdown. And my first instinct is to fire up another gambling ring and create a poker group.
But I would say that there is something fundamentally quite compassionate or there's at least a few more safety nets in a bunch of friends playing over Zoom during a specific time in history, which necessitates... a slight sort of indoor mania. Certainly from my perspective, I've always been more fearful of the kind of banter that's been thrown around on the Zoom rather than the kind of money that's been thrown around. I've gone to bed after more of those feeling like I let myself down there from a chat perspective than, goodness me, what another ruinous night.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you involved. And actually, it does link to this podcast because obviously this podcast is all about, you know, what you were like when you were younger and how you tried to do sort of creative ventures. And when I was younger, about 13, I did try to set up a casino in my house and charge people £1 entry to come into my house to play.
Really?
Which was nipped in the bud. So I was going around school. It was a half day at school. And I was like, right, there's going to be a casino in my house after school. I'm going to make a roulette wheel or whatever. And then we can play blackjack, etc. And then everyone was like, but it's £1 entry. Because I was like, come on, young enterprise. And then my parents quickly nipped that in the bud and said, you, of course, cannot charge your friends entry into your house, you maniac. What's wrong with you?
I think that's hugely enterprising. And far more so than my, frankly, like just humiliating attempt to, A, get a gambling ring going, and B, just have any mates when I was about 8, which was when I tried to set up a football pool at my first boarding school, Summerfields at Oxford. But we got a sweet ration every week, and the prize was my sweet ration. Because I was like,
"What? So that is some really on brand humility there." He's like, "No, I'm happy to.
I'll chuck in my curly whirly for this. I don't want you guys to feel that you're putting anything on the line. But you know, obviously, imagine the triumph for me when I predict all of this week's football scores correctly." And I get to keep my curly whirly.
you get to stay where you started.
So parents were like, you're charging people to enter your house, my parents were saying, you know, because I told them about this, I was like, I wasn't really hanging out with many of the people in my dorms, early doors, but since I started up this football thing, and they were like, oh, that sounds a bit gambly, but, fine, and what do you win? And I was like, oh, it's my sweet ration. Dad was just like, that sets a terrible precedent. And I can't...
And he was right to say that. He was basically, what you need is a middle ground between you and I. That's how to... If you look, any children listening who want to start gambling rings amongst their friends, and we do encourage it, I think you just need to find somewhere in between the way me and Ivo did it. You can't charge your friends entry, but you also can't offer... I mean, that my parents would have been equally angry if I said, you can come to my house and play in my casino. The prize is my house.
I think that was where I was heading with this. I think it would have gone beyond sweet rations to larger possessions quite quickly if I hadn't had that chat to my dad. And I'm glad that that didn't happen. All joking aside, important to say, I think, of course, that it is a serious business. And when the fun stops, double down, just
exactly.
And then eventually you'll win.
Google the martingale system and have yourself a laugh. Now, Ivo, I've got to guess what you were like at school. Before we delve too much deeper, I've got to guess what you were like at school. And I did pre-write this.
Because
okay?
It's the so first format come up in the last. Don't skip the catchphrase on me.
Well, you're the one person who has asked why that catchphrase exists.
Yeah, so. And therefore I was excited to be on the receiving end
this
of it.
This is series two, mate. The catchphrase is dead.
It's getting looser.
That was a series one catchphrase. Okay, sorry. So obviously there's stuff that I already know about you. I know that you were a polite, courteous child obsessed with writing thank you notes, right? So I'm not trying to just repeat things that I've heard you say. It's no secret what school you went to, and I don't really know what that's like. So I've had to go specific here. So, and bear in mind, I wrote this before you said the phrase sweet rations.
Okay.
Literally, the first line is, I think you put fizzy drinks on a pedestal. The theory is that it wasn't that easy to access fizzy drinks, so they were considered contraband, which excited a young Ivo when he could finally get his hands on a Dr. Pepper or a Lilt. I think you also had a real taste for games. Sure, you got your Super Marios, but also your British Bulldogs, and if the Eton grounds had access to such things, Kirby. What I'm saying is, this is a kid who knew his way around a Guess Who board, and don't even get him started on Risk. Now, earlier on this Skype that we're currently doing, in the background, this was confirmed to me as you sat in front of not one, but two different boxes of Ticket to Ride.
Yes, that's very on brand, and it wasn't meant to be for your benefit, but nor is it by accident, because I did force them into the backdrop of the latest episode of my pub quiz, where in just the most half-assed attempt to be some kind of late-night sort of talk show host, I thought, oh, there'll be different things in the background every episode, particularly during lockdown when I've been at my parents' house and there's quite a lot of their old books and various other sort of vaguely quizzy-looking things. But it's become an excruciating pre-match ritual, now sort of 15 episodes in, to an already pretty shambolic YouTube pub quiz, having to find new things that could go in the background. So this time it was just two Ticket to Ride boards stacked on top of each other.
Well, were you, just to go back to the thing, were you a big, was I right in thinking that you were a big gamesman throughout your school years? Or is that unfair to say? What I've written as well, just after that, is that I look at you and I think badminton. I don't know if that's fair or not.
Is right. I liked gamesman before it started straying into slightly more physical stuff like British Bulldog. That was obviously to be avoided at all costs. But games-wise, yes, I have talked. I mean, you've danced very tactfully and carefully around the many, many shameful bits of my adolescence that I've talked about in stand-up. And one of my earliest bits was about being as part of the Eton College Historical Board Game Society, where for a while I did meet up on Friday nights with other similarly lonely-minded teenagers to play board games, which were based in more historical fact than your average game of Risk.
Sorry. So to me, I was like, I'll put Risk in there as a sort of a nerdy one.
No.
And then you've gone with, sorry, actually, Risk is an embarrassment. If you want
to
do some proper board games.
Yeah, if you want to roll a dice, Reese, sure. But if you want to get...
None of these soldiers were actually red head to toe, so I don't want to play.
Nonsense.
Is that what you're saying?
I would like to receive the same amount of reinforcements of troops as my country would have received at that point during the First World War in a game such as, I don't know.
I actually forgot about the Historical Board Game Society, and me saying that you're a gamesman was based on your bit about scrolling to the bottom of Excel.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that's bleak, isn't it? It's all bleak.
there's more than you think in there. Everything's giving stuff away, Ivo. There's one final part of the prediction, which is, of course, academically excellent, slow to kiss girls, I imagine slightly discouraged creatively. So whenever you did anything inventive, you were considered an outlier. Pupils wanted to follow and teachers wanted to crush, but the pressure made you dizzy, so you parked it until uni.
some stuff completely bang on. I wouldn't say it's Sherlock level insight on the romantic front.
No.
But, God, no.
But I'm not, it'd be very rude for me to just point at you through my FaceTime camera and say, slow to kiss girls. I mean, it's not based on nothing.
No, but then I can't imagine you've had that many guests who have said, well, it was very difficult for me to dig out any creative work because obviously most of my teenage years were spent banging. That's not really the path that leads you. I didn't do anything as a teenager. That's what made the prospect of doing this initially so disappointing to me, because obviously a lovely podcast with a lovely friend and a lovely MO, but I don't think I did anything as a teenager, really. And I don't think that was because I was, what was your expression? Sort of followed by friends, but stamped on by teachers.
So an outlier that pupils wanted to follow and teachers wanted to crush.
Nobody wanted to follow me. And I don't think anyone wanted to crush me either. People very much had faith in my own ability to crush myself on a regular basis. And if it was anything, it was the other way around, in that I was not at the sort of full-scale bullied end of the spectrum, but I was quiet and on the sidelines. And occasionally, teachers would see a little promise and try and sort of coax a bit more confidence out. But it usually blew up in my face, such as in the 2004 Shakespeare declamation competition, which I was mistaken to win. Actually, it was a net loss overall. £25 of book tokens, but a year of stigma.
So wait. What happened? What is this competition for the benefit of the listener?
It was a Shakespeare reading competition where a mixture, a very disparate mixture of boys, some of whom were doing it for the tokens and some of whom were doing it for the bants, would declaim a bit of Shakespeare to the school. But you really wanted to be on the right side of that fence, or crucially, not participating at all. Whereas I was quite new to the school. I'd been a term late, so I was already at a bit of a remove socially. And then my English teacher, Mr. Welsh, who I've actually been in email touch with this lockdown, but I sent him an overly enthusiastic...
Of course you have.
He messaged out of the blue. I sent a response back that was too long and emotional. He hasn't replied to that. True story.
Really
dispiriting.
I mean, it's just... Yeah, I mean, it's nice, though, when someone builds a brand, it's nice that it isn't fake.
No.
It's nice that it's not a brand, is it? It's just, you're just honest about who you are, because this has enough, that's not got nothing to do with an act or...
No, not at all.
Without this podcast, you wouldn't have mentioned that. It's not... I don't know, maybe you would have, but it's just nice when it's like, right, you're living this character. It's not a character. This is exactly what it is the whole time and always has been.
Well, I think there's certainly a consistency to it, but I'm sure, you know, maybe there's a degree of cynicism that has crept in real life as well, where I'm like, well, this has started to actually serve me relatively well professionally, so maybe I should just let it bleed more and more into my personal life even I don't have to observe the boundaries anymore. You know, and certainly when I started doing stand-up about thank you letters, that definitely led to a real, trying not to use the expression, second wave, new burst of thank you letters from me, because people would be like, hang on, you don't write thank you letters anymore. I was like, I do. Let me just dust off the old vellum parchment, and then I would write a lot more off the back of that, because I didn't want to be accused of playing it up for, you know, Edfest Live.
Of course, you don't want to seem ungrateful as well. I mean, now, if anyone's ever seen you talk about thank you letters and then they don't receive one, they're going to think that you hate it.
And actually, when our daughter was born, we got presents and we didn't do thank you letters for a lot of those because it just the chaos of the time sort of claimed that as its victim. And I feel quite bad about that quite regularly. And friends of ours who've had babies since, and we've got them presents, you know, then, you know, 2 weeks or a month later, you get a lovely, sometimes a little bit generic thank you card back. But it plays on me, and I do feel like a fraud every time I don't do it. So at the beginning of lockdown, when we were all, even the parents amongst us, were quite time rich, I got this email out of the blue from Mr. Welsh, who guided me to victory as Malvolio in the Eton College Shakespeare reading competition in 2004. And I was like, I can't believe, and I have such fond memories of him, and you know, hadn't received any even confirmation that he was still, alive in the last 10, 15 years. So I was like, he's not getting a cursory two-liner. And I sent it off, and I thought, Mr. Welsh is going to feel like he has... He's going to feel very glad to have got in touch with me, because he's got a three-paragraph special. And then just nothing. I was like, maybe I've gone in too hard there.
I think it's one of two ways, isn't it? Either you have got in too hard and he, you know, has just gone, Jesus Christ, mate, that's a bit much. Or it was the emotional heft of the email you sent is still being processed.
That's what you hope. It's still being processed. But I think one of the lessons I have tried to learn in recent years, and this was particularly a thing, I think, when I was sort of sending... long messages to sort of people that I fancied in sort of the late noughties, early sort of tennies, was just that I remember showing my friend Ed an email that I'd sent someone that I thought that there might be some glimmer of hope with, and him wincing before he'd even read the content because he'd just seen just block paragraphs.
Oh no, just based on length alone.
And it's brevity is the key to so many things, and it's a lesson.
So you went into this Shakespeare reading competition, and you went in and you were doing it completely earnestly.
As earnestly as one can do the Malvolio Yellow Stocking speech from Twelfth Night, which is laden with dramatic irony. But yes, certainly in terms of, was I taking the piss out of the competition? No, I wasn't. And
percentage-wise, I mean, what sort of percent of the people who were in the competition would have been taking the piss versus doing it like you?
I'd say 2/3 taking the piss, 1/3 trying to win the Shakespeare Declamation Prize. But, you know, this was at an early... And I obviously hate to have a cheek pop at the even more scholarly Shakespeare declaimers, who, lest we forget, I beat. But some of them were lost causes already, whereas I was still hovering on the fence of, you know, of social viability. And then it was a real nailing my colours to the mast of, oh, I'm not ashamed to, stick around after English classes, Mr. Welsh, for some sort of tips on how my Malvolio is coming along. Very publicly go to his house for tea to discuss it further. You can imagine the kind of rumours that came off the back of that. And then just to go so gung-ho into the performance on the day. But then I look back at that and I think, well, it was public speaking of a sort, and that's what I'm doing now, and doing stand-up.
Sure, so the long-term results are evident. The short-term results, were they what you say they were? Were they what we expect, that you then were outcast and it struggled to get in on the cool gang, as it were?
It wasn't mega stigma. It was. It certainly wasn't the cool gang, but... Eton is a big school and there is a huge sort of sea of mediocrity and invisibility to lose yourself in. Mediocrity, these things are all relative. You know, we were driven.
Yeah, sure, yeah. I'm the most mediocre student at Eton. I mean, what a claim.
What a another moment of really tellingly misguided sort of faux humility from Graham there.
Was creativity encouraged at Eton from anyone? I mean, was it like, were there people at Eton who you would go, oh, that's that guy who, you know, I don't know, do people get up and do speeches?
Absolutely.
Did they do comedy skits they'd made in assemblies and stuff?
Yeah, there was a comedy society which where people would do little skits about life at the school. And again, you kind of had to be someone even to get up there. But it was... obviously, as a teenager, you thought that was the funniest thing in the world to see someone doing an impression of one of the teachers in front of everyone. And then some people, you know, multimedia was starting to play its part by 2005, 2006. And some people really got on that nice and early. Most notably, Tom Sturton and Tom Palmer, who obviously became the comedy duo Totally Tom, and have done various more prominent things in the sort of wider comedy world since. But they were, to say they were kings would be an understatement. You know, they they did all the serious stuff. They were in all the serious plays. They were all in all the funny plays. And they also did little video skits that would be passed around the school on USB sticks with new episodes of The OC and porn in a hidden folder. But the main thing was getting the new video by Sturman Palmer. And again, just... I just didn't really have...
Were those about school? Were those skits about school as well? Or did they sort of branch into the outside world?
It was mostly skits about school. That's my main memory of it. Which, you know, of course, some of it is fish in a barrel, but nonetheless, expertly shot. And, you know, a mixture of having the confidence to do that, having the fearlessness to take down some of the most imposing teachers at the school, and even just like having the tech and the time and the innovation to just go and film it around the place. I didn't have any of that. And whether that was sort of shyness or lack of ambition, I don't really know. But at school, any attempts to put my head above the parapet were grotesque failures. There was a thing that we did in the boarding house every night of the week. There was prayers, which I think back in the day was actually 50 boys praying together. Thank goodness Eton has become a slightly more secular school in the meantime. So it was just like house notices. But each boy in turn had to organise like a 5 or 10 minute entertainment slot to lighten up prayers. And some people would, you know, do a performance of something. Some people would like do a little mini debate. And I once proposed that we play a game from I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, a real Graham family favourite on Radio 4, where people sing along to songs and then they turn the music down and they keep singing and then they turn the music back up and you see if you're still in time with the song. And I was like, that would be a fun, like, you know, and I'm sure a few people would volunteer to do that. And I'd loosely scouted a couple of people and people have been quite non-committal. And so I proposed it in the house meeting and the housemaster said, well, Ivo, you'll obviously give us a demonstration to start off. And in sort of classic giving my own sweet ration away style, I was like, yeah, of course. It wouldn't be fair for me not to do it. So I sung my favourite pop rock song of the time, which was Vertigo by U2. not a cool choice. And also not even so uncool that it could potentially become sort of ironic and funny, like a, you know, a sort of rap or R&B song. Just quite an earnest sort of me pretending to be a 50-something Bono with wraparound specs, going, hello, hello, to rippling silence because the music had been turned down. Then he turned it back up. I was out of time, and the housemaster said, I think that'll be enough, actually. So I just sung a bit of Vertigo.
Oh, my God. Oh,
that was the end
God.
Of it.
So, oh, there's so much to unpack there. I mean... Really? So you, but I, why would the housemaster think that it was bad just because you weren't in time? Or was it just it was a horrible experience? Because surely not being in time is the whole fun of it.
I think, yeah, of course. But I don't. I think that's the fun of it when, you know, Graham Garden and Tim Brooke Taylor are doing it with 50 years worth of comic timing, not musical timing.
Yes, singing a song like, I mean, Vertigo, it's, I can't think of a worse choice. I mean, it's quite, they're quite long drawn out words in that song. He takes, it's like there's not a lot of lyrics and he takes a long time over a few words. It's also, it ages you in such a weird way. It's such a weird song for a teenager to be into.
It
was in the charts, but you too, and that just like, it's just so dad rocky. That it was, it's just such a bizarre, I mean, I don't, yeah, they, I mean, they wouldn't get the rights to it on Radio 4, so it would never come up, but it's
well, Radio
it's just
4,
a baffling.
It's all, you know, sort of hymns or, you know, old sort of, I don't know, if other rustic like sing-alongs. It's very rarely, as you say.
It can't be an actual pop song that you need to sing. It needs to be a song that's almost a chant.
And I don't think my housemaster was going, oh, well, Graham's lack of timing has been laid bare. I can't bear witness to any more of this. I think it was more, oh, this is quite, this is going to be humiliating for everyone who does it.
Yeah.
So even though it's doubly humiliating for it to be just Ivo, I think we're just going to have to sacrifice him.
Collateral damage.
More people.
Oh my God. You're the train dilemma.
Yeah.
That's exactly what that is.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And there was another one where I was, I put my name down to sing Linkin Park at a karaoke social with a nearby girls' school, where all the other people who'd volunteered to do the karaoke were doing boy band, girl band, or mixed boy and girl band stuff with their mates, and as a flirting exercise. And I volunteered to do a solo performance of Somewhere I Belong by Linkin Park, and it just didn't get picked up. And I remember, because I thought it was going to be the making of me, getting quite impatient and being like, some of these people put their songs down way after me, and only realizing, I think with the benefit of hindsight, that it was clearly a much more benevolent decision by whatever teacher was DJing this, you know, teenage karaoke disco.
And you were spared.
And then I watched About a Boy featuring
keep wanting so many of these stories are the plot to About a Boy.
when he thinks that singing in front of the school is going to be the making of him, and then his improbably cool female friend is like, they will crucify you, and then he does it anyway. I watched it and I was like, oh my God. And I didn't even have a sort of equally deluded Hugh Grant to, you know, come on with his guitar.
What's great about us talking about that film is that we both watch that film and we look at that character and we see ourselves, but for two very different reasons.
I would change that for just looking like him.
Yeah.
In a heartbeat.
So are we talking that these teenage years, just to get, let's get into the work, so that, am I right in thinking that, so you were creative at uni because you started doing stand-up, and the work is from when you were a bit younger. Is that right?
It was from when I was, from the late 90s, when I was at a pre-prep school called Stepping Stones and a prep school called Summerfields. And I think all of these are school exercises. So they're all in school books and they've all got teachers' notes underneath, some of which are far more valuable to the exercise than the actual writing themselves.
So what is it? So what is the stuff that you wrote that you've brought for today?
I was quite obsessed with... basically, I filtered football into most things that I was doing. And most of these exercise books have just got just endless scrawls, like terrible stick men sort of kicking a ball through the air and the ball whooshing as it flies towards an equally unconvincing goal net. And even the exercises that aren't meant to be out about it very quickly take a turn. So I'll give you an example. This is a short story that I was given to write on Monday, the 3rd of March, 1997. And the title, which clearly I've been given, is A Windy Night. One night when I was fast asleep, a thunderstorm blew around the house. Neither me, my sister, or my brother were awakened, though. We stayed asleep while the wind rattled around the house. But soon it died down, and suddenly, as if by magic, the gale had completely gone. Next morning, after breakfast, I settled down in front of the telly to watch the football. It was Manchester United against Tottenham Hotspur. The game was going tremendously by 3-0 to Manchester. Suddenly, Anderton got the ball, and Tottenham's players started to cheer as he dribbled the ball towards Manchester's goal. Quickly, Gary, also, great mental image of the Tottenham players not pouring forward in support, but just cheering.
The players cheering. The players cheering is so much fun.
Anderton's solo effort. Just like sort of FIFA fans, where they're just standing rooted to the spot.
I just imagine players suddenly getting out flags and scarves. And
come on, Darren, don't get injured. So... quickly, Gary Neville ran forwards, and soon the two of them were tackling. Then the whistle blew for half-time. When the game was going again, Giggs from Manchester handballed it, and Anderton lined up for the free kick, and Manchester's players gathered in front of the goal. Anderton kicked it at last, and it whizzed towards the goal. Neville leapt for it, but the ball went in. Too late, it was the end. Manchester's players cheered, and so did I. Then after supper, when I was in bed, the gale started again. And that's the end of the story. And my teacher has just written, I vote this is about a football match, not a windy night.
The wind is utterly irrelevant to that. I mean, it didn't have to be, because you could have quite what? Easily made the wind the carrying force of that
course.
Free kick.
An evening kickoff at a blustery old White Hart Lane.
There's no reason you couldn't have combined the two, but really you just went, it was windy one night, I woke up the next day, then I watched a football match, and then it was windy again. But yeah. There's no reason not to connect those things.
It's such a shame, isn't it? It's so sort of ballsy and complacent of me to just turn it completely to my own ends, but it's such a lack of creativity. But, you know, particularly from the hindsight of a stand-up, and we all know from writing Edinburgh shows how the crowbar is your greatest tool when you're just trying to mash together those four completely unrelated bits for your conclusion.
Just getting any kind of connection, setting any story within another story just makes the whole thing easier.
Yeah.
You hadn't yet learned that skill.
And the gale started again, so it's all come together.
It's a callback. End on a callback, as we know. Always end on a callback. Now, I've got to say, Ivo, I think this is the most out-and-out pandering to me that a guest has ever done, by literally having a story about a Tottenham match.
Yeah,
it does feel extremely like you've played into my hands here. I mean, we do lose in this story, but it was an era where we would never have beaten Man United, so it is realistic. Is it real? Was that a real
fixture? Oh, I looked it up. That the desperation, because I do think it's so satisfying when you look through an old diary and then, I mean, obviously, why would I lie? But I've got specific diary entries about matches that I watched, and they're sort of real. So, for example, I've got a diary entry and some really curious parenting on the part of my dad here. Half-term news, June 1997. A few days later, me and Daddy went to watch England v Poland at the Aldbourne pub. Everyone, including us, tried to guess who would score first for England. I tried Alan Shearer, and he did score first, so Daddy gave me £2 after the match. So my dad's taken me to the pub at the age of six. And again, lovely, the gambling theme rears its head.
Well, you know what? I take it back. When I opened this podcast by saying that I had encouraged you to have a gambling addiction, I don't think it's on me, actually.
It's my dad. He's given me £2, which is like, rather than just giving me my own sweet ration back. But I looked that up, and that's a World Cup qualifier from 1997. So I really wanted the Man U Tottenham match from a windy night to be real. But that's all my imagination. Darren Anderton did not score.
Wow, okay. Well, it's realistic imagination. Were you a big Darren Anderton fan? It sounded like you were.
He certainly plays a very dominant role in the Spurs team. But no, I was a Man U fan, to my great shame, because obviously I've been flying the Swindon flag increasingly performatively for the last, but certainly for the length of my career and basically for the last 20 years. But from 1997, 1998 to basically just after the treble, I was a Man U fan and I was obsessed with the Neville brothers.
Yeah, I noticed that because you claim that when Darren Anderton takes a free kick, that Neville leapt for it.
Yeah.
Which is very much the goalkeeper's role.
Yeah, no need for Schmeichel when you've got Neville leaping like a salmon in front of
leaping. Are there any other stories you were forced to write that you managed to crowbar in your actual interests?
Well, I would say there's a few more of that sort of specific ilk where it's like Jungle Book. And then, not Jungle Book, that's a real book, but, you know, it's something like, you know, a Day in the Jungle, and it's just a football tournament in the jungle. And Gary Neville's there again. So there is, and then there is a bizarre story where, and I don't remember whether this was encouraged at the time, but a lot of boys from my school make it in and all die. So this is from... This is from an exam, I think, because it says English 2 at the top, and it's on sort of, you know, it looks like an exam, and it's got a mark at the end, which out of 100, which you're very welcome to try and guess.
Fantastic.
And again, I don't know what the brief would have been for this, but it's so shit, but also just dark and clumsy. And it also, it displays a fascination with the world of nicknames, which obviously was, you know, a big thing of being a sort of a school
perfect.
Boy.
Perfect.
So, hello there. My name's, this is how the story starts. My name's Ivor Graham. I'm a perfectly normal boy, except for one thing. I've only got three fingers on my right hand. Don't worry, I'm not a vampire or anything. I just lost it once. What? You want to know how I lost my little finger? All right, I'll tell you. And there's a big old two-line space. I wish you all a very happy holiday. I waited for the headmaster's next sentence. Then suddenly it dawned on me. He'd finished. Yippee! I rushed out of school. It was the summer holidays. I joined up with my 16 classmates and we set off home together. Then we came to a fork in the... So this is completely implausible. First, I mean, we'd have been picked up from our boarding school by our parents.
We of course. Up.
But in this, we've, it's the last day of term. I've somehow just realised this. And then it's a big old walk down the road together. Then we came to a fork in the road. A car came towards us, so we all stepped onto the pavement. Suddenly, the car, the fork, and everything else disappeared. We fell down, down. We landed on rock. We looked up. We were in a rocky desert. Suddenly, there came a roar, and a monster was coming towards us. I'd say just pick one of any of those things.
It certainly escalates quite quickly, and then you keep your options open.
I keep my options very open. And also, I would love a monster to enter the realistic world of a walk home, but the sort of falling implausibly and then everything disappearing and then a desert and then the monster. Anyway, we rushed down a slope with James Muzz Musgrave in front. So everyone gets their sort of inverted commas nickname in the middle.
Were these are real these nicknames?
Are all, some are real nicknames. They're all real boys from my year at school. We came to the edge of a cliff, but only Muzz had seen it. Stop, he cried. We all stopped. Then Julian Harvey at the back slipped. Still one of my best friends. Haven't called him Harv for about 20 years. We all fell forward. Muzz tried to stop, but he couldn't. He fell off the cliff and disappeared. Then I suddenly remembered something. The monster. Go, I shrieked. We stopped sadly, looking at where Muzz had been and jerked into life. I was at the back now with Glennie Parr. I heard a guzzling noise, but did not look back. The monster, fatter than when we had first seen it, grabbed my leg. I took my pocket penknife out and killed it. Brilliant. But then we saw that Glennie wasn't with us. We all guessed what had happened. The monster had eaten him. Now, I'm already getting quite bored of this exercise, and it's very formulaic. Basically, in an anticipation, I think, of the reality shows of the late 90s and early noughties, I eliminate my schoolmates one by one in a series of different ways. None of them
they get evicted.
Massively imaginative. They fall off cliffs. They get eaten by monsters. Lion, tiger, alligator, pretty much all different animals. Quicksand obviously plays a huge part. Two people go into quicksand.
You can't have a childhood story without quicksand. No. Two of them go in quicksand.
One of them goes into quicksand and then... And then Jamie Sums Summer tries to go and rescue George Limo Leeming from the quicksand and meets a similar fate. And then soon enough, it's just me and Alexander Quags Clark. He falls down a hole. Meanwhile, I slay all of the animals with my penknife. And then I notice at the end that one of my fingers had come off when the bear bit me. And then the story ends, and then I realised that was what had happened, and that's the end. That's the end of the story. Maybe I've run out of time. We've all, you know, packed too much in.
What I love about that is that the intro to the story being, you're probably wondering how I lost this finger. No. If you've got a story to tell, the story isn't how I lost my finger. I know that's the creative element of it, is to go, well, actually, all this stuff happened. But surely it would be, you're probably wondering how I've got this haunted look on my face from seeing all my friends eaten by various animals, drowned in quicksand and pushed off cliffs.
But I'm so jolly about that, actually, because I go through this whole escapade with an increasingly competitive air about me, as if knowing that, you know, Hunger Games style, only one can remain. It's really jaunty, and I would say, by the way, that gets 68 out of 100, so it's a high 2-1.
Interesting. Okay, I wonder. I don't think I'd have. I reckon I'd have gone somewhere in the 70s. So that's fair enough. What I would say is, when you started introducing these nicknames, right? You started off with Muzz and Harv, and I was thinking, now these
are not the nicknames of boarding school boys.
Oh, right, yeah.
These are the nicknames of Blazing Squad members. Then, thankfully, just to allay any doubts I had, the next one was Glenny. I was like, right, we're back. Quags, Sums. That's what I expected to hear. Glenny, Quags and Sums. None of this Muzz and Harv nonsense.
Glenn Parr, I'm almost certain, didn't have a nickname. The rest have the ring of familiarity about them to me. But I've just, you know, I've realised that that's basically the only constant in this flailing short story.
Did you have a nickname?
No, not to my... I think the thing about Ivome is that it is...
Very distinctive
Vaguely
name.
Distinctive and Graham doesn't really fit to anything. There was a bit of Graham and then a bit of, I'm afraid to say, Gayham at a couple of points. Not very good.
That will happen.
Obviously. But obviously everyone involved has educated themselves since. And no, I don't think that ever... And then, oh, actually, when I went to Eton as a teenager, I'd been at school in Australia for a few years, so I was nicknamed Skip, as in the bush kangaroo, and that stuck around a lot longer than any name-based abbreviation.
Wow, Skip. I can't picture it.
No, I had a slight Australian twang, which I had desperately tried to pick up.
Oh, did you?
Because I was trying to shake off all the, you know, posh English guy stuff from Australia, and then just as I started to blend... Dad's work in the world of insurance pulls him back to the Northern Hemisphere, and there I am getting teased again in the opposite fashion. Can I read you some more quite bleak stuff that I wrote when I was at Summerfield? So we start to move into slightly darker territory here with a prose poem called The Drink Driver.
Ooh.
Again, you'll maybe have your own questions, not just about my literary stylings, but my personal life off the back of this. And we'll see if those are reflected in the feedback I get from my teacher at the end. So this is written on the 9th of February, 2000, so I would have been 9. The lights are on in the pub, and people are dancing on tables, singing songs, and drinking far too much beer. They're all grown-up men who know this is illegal, but they don't care. my teacher's just put next to it, why is it illegal? Which is bang on. get off those tables. They're all too drunk for words and completely stoned out. Wouldn't have known what that meant.
Completely stoned out. I mean, have you ever been to a pub, seen a bunch of grown men dancing on tables and thought, you know what, that's a real sign of a stoner, that.
Obviously,
energy, the energy to be boogieing on a table.
It is the literal opposite of the kind of Friday night energy that I'm conveying in stanza one. But there we go. As far as I was concerned, on the 9th of February 2000, they go hand in hand. One man's gone crazy. He runs out of the pub and takes a car. He drives onto the motorway. He's going the wrong way, but he doesn't care. It's midnight as he drives onto the deserted road, completely dark. He thinks the road's clear, but there's a car coming. There's a screech of brakes, but they're still going to crash. But he doesn't care. I hope you've picked up on the theme of not caring.
Yeah.
Final stanza. The bumpers bump together. There's a shriek from the other vehicle. In a burst of flames, the car rolls down the hill to crash upon the ground, and the silly man dies. He does care now. What a twist. Conscience. Finally.
Wow. What a great advert for poetry. That's so good. That's such a 9-year-old's image of what happens in pubs and what happens in cars. I mean, everything is wrong.
So, yeah, right. Not to, obviously, again, having already made light of gambling, not to make light of these sorts of very real adult problems, but even within the world of the kind of sort of things that happen, running out of a pub, hammered and stoned, lest we forget, running out of an all-male pub, just grabbing a car where the strong implication is it's not your car, and then
takes
a car and then just driving the wrong way onto a motorway immediately.
Well, yeah, takes a car. When you leave the pub, where are you going? Oh, motorway. Oh, is it your local, is it?
No, it's 2 hours away.
Just pop down the motorway to the pub. He doesn't care the whole way through until he's now dead and it's impossible to care.
When it comes too late.
I love the idea that your teacher wrote, why is it illegal? And I'm only imagining a panicked teacher who was dancing on tables that weekend going, oh, was there CCTV?
Oh, no.
Is it illegal? Is this how I find out?
I toked, but I didn't inhale. Is that okay?
It now comes to the time where I must score your work. Three categories. They are, of course, originality, pure teen horniness, and the Mickey Mouse Club Ryan Gosling Ryan Goose score. So, first of all, originality. I'd be hard pressed not to give it a pretty high score. You've worked very hard to crowbar your interests into irrelevant stories, and I've not seen that actually very often. Most people do stick to the task, but you have really taken a tangent off a windy night to just get straight into Man United beating Tottenham 3-1. And your imagery, like Tottenham players cheering as Anderson runs through, I've never had that image in my head before because it is insane. Similarly, managing to describe a bunch of people in a pub dancing on a table who must be stoned out, and taking a car from the pub immediately onto a motorway. It's like a surrealist poetry. It's actually just the padding and waffle of a 9-year-old, it turns out. But and the adventure where everyone dies. I mean, quicksand, I'd be harsh to mark you down for quicksand on originality, given that, you know, it was so ubiquitous as kids. We couldn't avoid it as kids.
It's still
bad, though.
It was just
in the consciousness.
I think that my plotting of my classmates' deaths is pretty lazy from start to finish in the story of my lost finger.
But the fact it's a story of a lost finger and it's not just here's a story of my classmates' deaths scores you originality points. So I'm going to go 4 out of 5 for originality. Pure teen horniness, I mean...
None? Look, would you say none?
Yeah, I mean, it's negative horniness. I mean... Sorry, Ivard, I know you don't want to hear that, but... In fact, when I knew that you were going to be bringing early work to me, I did think, I bet this isn't pretty pure teen horny. I didn't think it would be quite this unhorny. It's all death. It's perhaps the least horny thing in my life, Tottenham losing, and it's drink driving. So it's pretty death heavy. It's got to be zero.
I think it's a legitimate zero. I'm pleased not to have gone into negative figures with that.
No, I wouldn't be that harsh. And then Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score. How close is it to your work now? Does it show the potential of a future star? Well, I mean, there's definitely elements of your vibe. I mean, the sort of posh naivety of saying a phrase like stoned out. I could see you using that intentionally, ironically, now.
Oh, no, I'm not. How dare you? In a sort of, we were doing the drugs. I don't know why I'm calling it doing
not
the drugs.
That, no, away. Not that level. A little bit better than that. But yeah, I don't quite mean that.
No,
but,
I know yeah, I what you mean. No, from. It's definitely, I want to say malapropism that I would lean into in my work.
There is a line in one of your stories that I have heard you use, which is, hello, my name is Ivo. I've heard you use that a number of times.
Okay.
The fact, the football stuff, there's definitely elements. There's definitely elements of it in there. As you say, you know, the comic's best tool is the crowbar, and any comedian knows that if you've got to get from one topic to the other, just go to bed and wake up the next day and talk about that. That's what we all do in stand-up. I'll go for a 3.
Oh, that's very generous.
3 out of 5 for Mickey Mouse Club. So it's a 7 out of 15 is your score. And now it comes to the time when I've got to read, I'll read you something. So what I'm going to read you... Extremely appropriately, I found this notebook the other day. It's got Roy Lichtenstein's Wham on it. I bought it at the Tate when I was 15.
Did you go to Lichtenstein? That was
yeah, and I would have thought it was the best thing ever.
I still kind of do.
Because it's
I
a cartoon.
I'm quite basic.
Yeah. And in this, appropriately, I found a very, very short
poem I wrote about poker.
Yes, brilliant.
It's really short, but let's see. Okay, it's not finished as well. It's clearly not finished. The first half of the page is taken up by a different poem that I've already read on this show. And then the second half is this poker poem. So it's untitled. It just starts, "What will become of bluffing after a million tomorrows of winning nothing? Sometimes my hand can't prevent me from falling the numbers which I keep on calling. Eventually, though, I go all in." And then in brackets, it says, don't tell that my hand's in my pocket, dash, good shuffling. Just an idea at the bottom, but I don't know what it means. But there you go. There's a little poem about poker.
I really like it, Rhys. It feels like that should come out at some point on one of our weekly poker Zooms.
But, oh, the pressure.
That's your choice and not mine.
There's a little line. Just reading that, then I realised. Oh, okay, there's a little idea there. Sometimes my hand can't prevent me from falling. I just got that as I read that.
I think it's really nice, actually. Well, how old would you have been?
I think 15 or 16.
Perfect.
Playing poker at friends' houses quite a lot. Trying to start casinos in my own house.
Yep. And most importantly, understanding poker as a metaphor for the futility of life.
Yes. What will become of bluffing after a million tomorrows of winning nothing? It's so on brand.
I think that's such a good line, Rhys. I think I've got to say, I think I'm easily seduced, particularly after you've heard the not even attempts to make anything poetic about the drink driver. So
sure.
There's a great line in one of the Alan Partridge books where he says, "For me, I'll always prefer a poem that rhymes to one that doesn't. It just suggests the writer has put in that little bit more effort." And I genuinely feel that. I was like, God, he's done well there.
Yeah, well, it's just a 5-line poem. Normally I read something longer, but given that we'd been talking about this already, I felt very appropriate to read that to you. So I need your rating just on that. It's not a lot to work with. But
in all three categories?
Yeah. I think so, yeah. I mean,
well, how similar?
If you think you can stretch to rate that.
Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose, as discussed, you are making these kind of snap judgments across the virtual bays on a weekly basis. So that's a 4.
Sure.
Pure teen horniness. Sure. You know, it's a young gambler. It doesn't explicitly relate to romance, but I'd say it certainly does a lot more than my Manchester United 3, Tottenham 1, so it's getting a 3 for that.
Well, I think that the brackets is leaning towards a joke about that. Don't tell me that my hand's in my pocket, good shuffling, I think is potentially moving towards
sorry.
A pretty gross analogy.
I do apologise. It's straight up to 4. And, yeah. I mean, if not 5, really. Pure shuffling. I'm really sorry not to have credited that immediately. And the third category is originality. And I would say probably that's where it scores lowest. By your own very high standards, sure. That's probably a 2.
Okay, I'll take that. So it's a 10. I get a 10 out of 15, which plays to your 7, which means that I am the winner of the episode. But Ivo, some catchphrases do live on for Series 2. And there are no winners. We are both losers.
Yes.
That will never die, that catchphrase. I don't
so
know if you know that catchphrase, if you've ever got this far in an episode before. But that is the catchphrase at this stage of the podcast.
Of course. But I still like listening to it, and but also being the loser, even within the losing.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, now it comes to the time for you to play us out with your final piece, whatever it may be, that producer Neil will soundtrack. With either sound effects, if they're appropriate, for example, someone drowning in quicksand, having their finger cut off, or attacking a monster with a penknife, or just lovely music, if we need to hear someone partying in a pub.
I'm going to read something, even though it's a tiny bit long, because I think it hints at the same darkness as The Drink Driver, and it has another great note from my teacher at the end. And this is a relatively short story called Literary Enchantment, and I'll go through it as quickly as I can and skip any irrelevant passages. Jason Birkin sat bored in his seat. This talk had been going on for ages. He didn't like assembly. Every fortnight for the whole 4 years had been a lecture. His mind drifted and his eyes drifted to the wall above the speaker's head where there was a notice. He'd never seen it before. In big bold letters were written, "We remember them, those who died at St. George's." Interesting, thought Jason. He looked at the list below. It was written in considerably smaller writing, and he strained his eyes. The names were mainly from World War I and II, but there was one name under the heading Other, Ian McPhee, 1987. Jason was concerned by this. The next day after the lecture, he asked Mr. Vine, the geography teacher, and the only one who'd been at the school since 87, about Ian McPhee. Said Mr. Vine, Ian McPhee. Now, he was a good lad, captain of the rugby team and squash team and football team and on course to be head boy. But then at the start of his fifth year, he got hold of this book, Golden Water, I think it was. He was obsessed and he became a complete bookworm. He lost interest in everything. He just read that book. And then he died. How? Asked Jason. Sorry, Jason, I don't know. Okay, sir, said Jason, and left. Asterisks to indicate time passing. In the next few days, Jason thought a lot about the book Golden Water. How could a book completely change somebody's lifestyle? And obviously, in the TV adaptation, that would be the sentence in the trailer. How could a book completely change somebody's lifestyle? It must be interesting, he thought. So he went up to the library to look. He wandered around for a long time and eventually found it, Golden Water by Alan Marks. He looked at the sign-in page of previous readers. There it was, the only name, Ian McPhee, scrawled in untidy handwriting. He flicked onto the first page and started to read. Chapter 1, The Task Ahead, the first of the 560 that he read. Hey, this was good. He slumped into a chair and continued. He read for 15 minutes, then the bell went for lunch. He ignored the bell. He was oblivious to everything but this wonderful book. Soon he was on page 48 and was enjoying it even more. 10 more minutes went by. Then a prefect poked his head round the door. Lunch, you idiot, you're late. Didn't you hear the bell? Oh, lunch, said Jason, and promptly started to read again. Hey, exclaimed the prefect. Don't ignore me. Off to lunch with you. Jason went to the door, signed the book out, slipped into his gigantic pocket, and went for lunch. However, as soon as he was seated and the master had finished telling him off for his lateness, he delved into his pocket, pulled out the book, and kept reading. He loved it. He couldn't stop for silly old lunch. He read throughout, then went to reading period. A perfect period to read. What a terrible sentence. Then he smuggled it into games and read it in the lessons afterwards, ignoring the master's explaining decimal division or the fifth declension. He read it at supper, and soon he was on page 196. His friends were starting to notice, especially after supper, when he missed cricket nets, his favourite activity. He read throughout. When his best friend, Billy Richards, came halfway through and reminded him about cricket nets, the reaction wasn't the, oh yes, whoops, Billy had expected. It was, forget it, I'm not going. This went on for days. The biggest disaster then occurred when he finished the book. It said, read the sequel, Slush and Mud. Jason had to get this book. He ransacked the library, but he couldn't find it. He needed it. He depended on it. He went home and searched every library in the district, but still couldn't find it. He was driven into stress. He went back to school and it got worse. It drove him crazy. There was only one thing to do. He grabbed a dressing gown cord and tied it round his neck. He pulled the edges and slumped to the floor. There was, and this is a fantastic word here, there was a rumpus and people crowded round. Funny, said Mr. Vine. That's how Ian McPhee died. And the book seemed to chuckle. And that's the end of the story.
Oh my God.
So I do apologise because that is too long. But.
Not. I mean, right. Much like young Jason Birkin and Ian McPhee, I was absolutely gripped. And I'm glad we had closure at the end. No, I'm not entirely convinced I approve of the ending.
Of course not. But also, a bit like The Lost Thinker, absolutely no effort to convey what was so thrilling about the book. There's nothing.
Yeah, just, it's a good book. It's a really good book. And if you can't read the second one, you will kill yourself.
So my teacher underneath has written, a tremendous tale. Well done. But perhaps the suicide is just a touch too abrupt. Imagine giving that note to a 9-year-old in your creative writing class.
Perhaps the suicide is it. Well, actually, I mean, except
what I've learned is that if you don't talk about football, everyone dies.
Yeah. That's the warning I was essentially throwing out. There's a chronology to these stories where I clearly get a quite sort of strong verbal warning to stop making my stories about football. And I'm like, well, if you don't want that, you're getting this.
There we go. Just two gamblers riffing on drink driving down the motorway to get home from the pub after smoking doobies and dancing on tables. What a sweet view of what it's like in pubs. And actually, I can tell you, having been to the pub with Ivo as an adult, he still thinks you're supposed to do that. Not a trip to the pub goes by where Ivo isn't blazing it while going full coyote ugly on the bar before hopping in his Ford Focus and swerving down the M25. Shout out Darren Anderton, obviously. Shout out Harv, Glennie, Muzz. Shout out Jason Birkin, of course. And make sure to check out Ivo's current work. It's excellent and arguably just marginally better than his early work. As ever, please do subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. Give us a rating and a written review if you're kind. And please transfer me £30 on the poker app of your choice. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.